This is Community in Conversation with Kathy Kayla, starting conversations that matter.
Please note that the following program is not suitable for children. Good morning, I'm Kathy Kayla. Thank you for joining me for this Community in Conversation. He's an American Orthodox rabbi, author, and TV host. He's the author of 31 books, including the bestseller Kosher Sex, A Recipe for Passion and Intimacy, and Kosher Jesus. His outspokenness has earned him praise and criticism. The Washington Post referred to him as the most famous rabbi in America. Newsweek named him one of the 10 most influential rabbis in the United States, and the Jerusalem Post named him one of the 50 most influential Jews in the world. Welcome, Rabbi Shmuley Bateach. How are you?
Thank God, very well. Thank you for having me. I love South Africa, and I so lament that the coronavirus, the disgusting coronavirus that hopefully God will banish from the earth, has separated all of us. So I haven't visited South Africa in more than 2 years. So being able to broadcast into South Africa is the next best thing. So thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. And it's very late where you are. Really, thank you for making the time. You are one of the world's top experts in marriage and relationships. So I thought, even though you've written this new book called Kosher Hate, which has nothing to do with marriage, although maybe in some cases it might, but we're going to be talking about that. But I also wanted to take advantage of the fact that you're on the line to speak to you about marriage and relationships. I checked out the statistics, the global statistics on marriage, and it's on a very, very slow and gradual decline. Fewer people are getting married. 69% in 1970 and 64% last year globally. Is there still a place for marriage?
That's a fair question. Well, people see marriage as boring and monotonous. It's, quote, settling down, end quote. They don't want to settle down unless they're forced to. They want to live passionate lives. They want to feel like they're fully alive. And people don't necessarily feel that marriage makes them experience that emotion. What we're seeing is people who are partying and living it up in their 20s, either completely single or practicing serial monogamy in and out of relationships. And they're not ready to really tie the knot. To the extent that marriage has been portrayed as being institutionalized because it's seen as an institution, and to the extent that marriage is seen as a form of confinement, imprisonment, it is turning people off. But I've made it my lifelong mission to show precisely the opposite. Marriage is actually the best way to experience the height of emotional ecstasy, sexual pleasure, romantic inspiration. There's nothing like marriage. There's nothing like having one person who knows you fully and completely, someone with whom you can remove artifice, someone with whom you can be completely yourself and natural, and someone with whom you can swing from the chandeliers. The key is to keep marriage passionate. And that's what my books have been all about, from Kosher Sex to Kosher Lust to Lust for Love, which I co-authored with Pamela Anderson. It's about passionate monogamy and not boring monogamy.
Bottom line, why get married when you can cohabit quite happily and easily today?
Well, you know what? It's a fair question. My simple, straightforward answer is that people actually want to be married. They don't want to be in a relationship that is so undefined. If I say that I'm in a relationship, it means almost nothing. It's a fair question to ask, is it a serious relationship? Is it not? Is it a casual relationship? But if I say I'm married, no one's going to say, is it casual? There's no such thing as casual marriage. Marriage is as serious and as intense as it gets. I think we get married for the intensity of the experience. We get married in order to feel like there's an exclusivity to our relationship and there's definition to it. It allows us to let go and to be innately present, to be fully present in the relationship. When we're not married, we're not fully present because we don't know what the contours of the relationship are. It can end tomorrow via text or email. But in a marriage, it's a serious, very serious commitment. And it's what we all really seek. Like I said, it's not that people have an issue with marriage. They have an issue with the boring marriage. So the key is not to convince people to marry. It's to convince people that marriage can be ecstatic, that it could be wonderful, that it could be romantic, that it's not just about children and it's not just about sharing a mortgage, but it's about letting go fully so you could be full, you could be completely present in a relationship with someone in a way that just really takes you to the mountaintop. I think that dating is life in the valleys and marriage is life at the mountain summit. And that's how I've always tried to portray it.
When I knew that I was going to be speaking to you, I asked my friends about marriage. And one theme that came up was loneliness in a marriage. How do you address loneliness in a marriage?
Well, that's one of the saddest things that I've experienced as a marital counselor, that, you know, there are people who, if you're single and you're lonely, you can always look forward to assuaging your loneliness through marriage. But if you're married and you're lonely, what do you have to look forward to? That's a really sad state of affairs. And there are many people who are lonely in marriage. And the best way to remedy is, look, a lot of marriages need help. They need assistance. There's nothing wrong with going to a marital counselor. There's nothing wrong with speaking to a wise friend. I think that we should embrace our frailty, our humanity. Last week's Torah reading was Vayishlach. It's all about how the Jewish people are Israel, which means wrestling with God. There's nothing wrong with wrestling with life's greatest issues, including wanting to better our marriages. So number one, if you're large, your marriage needs help and you should go to a wise friend or to a trained professional. Number two, if you're lonely in your marriage, you really have to communicate with that to your spouse. Don't just grin and bear it. Don't just suck it up and internalize it. Don't just have television or Netflix or, I don't know, the internet filling the empty void of the absence of conversation and communication. You have to communicate it. And a lot of people are afraid to raise problems in the marriage. It's like, don't fix that which is broken. But if you're lonely in your marriage, then it really is broken and it has to be addressed. If you're a woman listening to this and you're alone in your marriage, you need to sit with your husband and say, listen, you know, I love you and I love that we have children. I love you. We have a life together, but I don't feel that you fully focus on me. I don't feel that I'm completely understood. I don't feel that you are sufficiently interested in my day-to-day life or my dreams, my aspirations, my fears, my anxieties, my loneliness. I don't feel you ask me about it. Now, a lot of women especially are loath to have that conversation because they don't want to sound like they're nagging their husbands. But, you know, you don't go into marriage to be a hero. You're not there to be a champion. Like, oh, I can surmount every obstacle. I don't get lonely and I don't want to be the kind of wife who nags her husband. No. You can't think that way. You didn't get married to be alone. You didn't get married to be lonely. In fact, the very first thing that God says in the Bible that is bad is that it's bad for man to be alone. Lo tov hayos adam levado. It's not good for people to be alone. We get married to assuage loneliness. So don't allow yourself to experience loneliness in marriage. Fix the relationship.
Do you believe in love at first sight?
I believe in attraction at first sight. I don't believe in love at first sight. I take love far too seriously to believe it can happen instantaneously. So no, I absolutely reject any belief and love at first sight. I certainly believe in magic at first sight, chemistry, you know, instant attraction. But no, love is something that is experienced through a shared existence. And it's love is life's most beautiful thing. And like an onion with infinite layers, it has, you know, you have to peel away one skin and then another skin and we fall more deeply in love and there's no end to it. It's something infinite. As God is infinite and all love comes from God, so too love is infinite. So I would never say that there's love at first sight, but there is attraction at first sight.
There's a Jewish concept of a beshet, the one who's destined to be your partner. Can you explain that a little bit more to me?
Yeah, sure. Beshet is best translated as intended one or soulmate. It means that God has a plan for the romantic dimension of all of our lives, that there's someone predestined to assuage our loneliness and one who's uniquely attuned to our talents, our person than anyone else. That's a soulmate. That's a beshert. But let me caution people. You see, God knows who our beshert is, but we don't. So a lot of people actually use the beshert idea against themselves. They'll date and they'll feel, I don't feel like this is my beshert. I always say that besherts are not created, they are committed. You discover someone is your beshert through committing to them, through dating seriously and allowing yourself to fall in love and removing fear and anxiety from a relationship. A lot of people have a commitment phobia. There's both active commitment phobia, where you date and you start getting very anxious that this is getting serious. And there's passive commitment phobia, where you sabotage the relationship before it even begins by dating people who are completely inappropriate. So a lot of people use the Bouchard idea against themselves. It's like, oh, I'm going to end this relationship because I don't feel this is my Bouchard. You don't know if it's your Bouchard. Only God knows. God wants you to discover your Bouchard is through a process of healthy dating. And healthy dating, it always involves four stages. Stage number one is attraction. You're drawn mysteriously to someone for reasons you can't even explain. Stage number two is verbal exploration. You start speaking. Stage number three is emotional intimacy. You start sharing secrets. And stage number four is physical intimacy. You start knowing each other carnally. Because strangely enough, Judaism believes that sexual intimacy is the highest form of knowledge. In Hebrew, the only word for sex is yedia, knowledge, which is a fascinating idea that we can know someone physically even better than we can know them through verbal communication and through emotional exploration. But you need to follow those four steps. When you do them out of order, when you date, if you do stage number one, attraction, and you immediately go to stage number four, physical intimacy, you start having sex the way so many people do before they have a, you know, stage number two, verbal exploration, or stage number three, emotional intimacy. If you do them out of order, that's how you get loneliness in a relationship. We modern men and women find it so easy to take our clothes off with someone and to get physically naked, but we find it so difficult even in marriage to be emotionally naked. We don't necessarily remove our fears, anxieties, our deepest secrets, even when we're married. And that's where loneliness ensues. So you discover who your Bouchard is through a process of dating. But you're not clairvoyant. You're not a prophet. You don't know that this is, whether or not this is your Bouchard. You will find out serious commitment in dating.
Rabbi Boteach, is there a relationship between an emotional connection to your partner, your spouse, and sexual gratification?
Yes. There's definitely a connection between great sex and emotional commitment, emotional connectivity. Because without being emotionally attuned with your partner, and preferably your spouse, because I'm a great believer in sex and marriage specifically, without the emotional connection, what we end up having is physical friction. You may have the friction of two bodies that can create sparks, but you don't let go of artifice. Your innermost self is still holding itself back. Why is sex the most pleasurable of all human experiences? And the main reason is sex is where we allow our carnality to breathe free. It's where there's nothing premeditated. We're not thinking about the next move. We're not thinking about bad sex is where you do all that. It's where your mind is so involved in the process because you feel so judged. You think you're with someone who's been with many other people and they're wondering, are they attracted to your body? You become very self-conscious about form as opposed to substance. Great sex is where none of that premeditation and calculation is present. So when you're emotionally engaged, you're completely comfortable. You're not feeling evaluated. This is not the sexual Olympics. You actually are feeling completely embraced. You're feeling that someone just desires you. There's deep desire because there's emotional connection. But when there's not emotional connection and it's just form without substance, when it's our body without soul, when it's sex without love, then that is actually absent and it's nowhere near as special. And it's nowhere near as passionate and it's nowhere near as ecstatic.
We live in a world where sex has become less taboo, and yet in our community, in the Jewish community, it has become more taboo. People don't discuss sex, not even with their partners. They don't tell their partners, this is what I like, this is what I don't like. Why do you think that is?
Because people are very shy, understandably. And I think there should be a certain modesty about sex, but not in marriage. A woman wrote to a famous rabbi 1,000 years ago, the Meiri, and an Orthodox woman at the time, as was most of the community, and she basically wrote and said, how is it that on my wedding night, I'm supposed to lose all modesty and become completely intimate with someone who I'm just, you know, he's become my husband through marriage, but we're still not, we don't know each other fully. And the Meiri said that the whole reason that we practice modesty in Judaism is when we voluntarily give up that modesty in order to be intimate with a spouse, it actually excites and enhances attraction. So in other words, shyness is appropriate. Modesty is appropriate outside of marriage. It's not appropriate inside of marriage. We're supposed to feel completely comfortable with our spouse. It's actually lamentable that so many people remain sexually inhibited in marriage. I know husbands and wives who have been married decades and they've never revealed sexual fantasies to each other. They've never revealed deep erotic desire to each other. Now that's appropriate with strangers. It's not appropriate with your sexual soulmate and your spouse. So it comes with practice. We have to learn how to communicate intimately in marriage. Not, as I said before, it's a strange thing about the modern world that people find it so easy, ostensibly, to get physically naked. So for example, I don't know about South Africa, but in the United States, statistics are that like 1 out of 3 dates, first dates end up in sex. 1 out of 3. So people find it very easy to get physically naked. And yet they find it so incredibly challenging to get emotionally naked or erotically naked, to reveal fantasy, to reveal a deep sexual self. But as I said, that's appropriate specifically in marriage. And husbands and wives should achieve that degree of intimacy because marriage is all about being complete soulmates, romantic soulmates, sexual soulmates, emotional soulmates, psychological soulmates, and the highest level, spiritual soulmates.
What I'm hearing you say is that you have to be willing and able to be vulnerable to your spouse. And that vulnerability sometimes means putting out your fantasy and not worrying about being judged. But what happens if your spouse is going to judge you?
Well, that's an unhealthy marriage, very unhealthy. Whenever you feel judged in your relationship, judgment is appropriate for strangers. It's not appropriate in intimate relationships. By the way, let's move away from marriage for a moment, but look at family. Look at parents and children. A lot of kids feel very judged by their parents, and they end up hiding things from their parents. They'll open up to friends, but they won't open up to mom and dad. That's not healthy, because we parents are supposed to be the principal influence on our children. So that's already an example of how even in a nuclear family, you can have unhealthy tendencies of feelings of judgment, children who feel judged, or they can never live up to their parents' expectations. Now let's move it into the marriage. A lot of husbands and wives feel that way about each other. How many men feel like they want to be outstanding providers for their families in general, for their wives in particular, and they feel judged in terms of being moneymakers, earners. I know a lot of men who experience tremendous fear of failure, even within their own marriages. That's not healthy. Of course, you know, that kind of is, it's a stereotype, which we're thank God letting go of, because of course women today are also earners, but a lot of men haven't let go of that idea that they're supposed to principally be providers. And that's very unhealthy because they don't understand they're not supposed to be only physical providers, they're supposed to be emotional providers. They're supposed to be fully emotionally present in their marriages, but they feel judged by, or in their minds, they feel judged by a spouse. Well, the same thing is true with a woman, with a wife. She can feel as she gets older that her husband judges her. I counsel so many couples where, and this is a really sad thing, you know, once upon a time, one of the biggest problems in marriage was infidelity and unfaithfulness. Today, one of the biggest problems in marriage is not that people are having affairs, but pornographic addiction. You know, pornography counts for something like 70% of the internet. So here's the greatest human invention since we landed a man on the moon back in 1969, and 70% of it is pornography. It's infiltrating many marriages. So a lot of women are in relationships where they feel judged physically because they think that their husbands are consuming untold numbers of images. You know, pornography kind of caters to a very toxic masculinity. It's extremely unhealthy for marriages. But I would say that out of the blue, I don't know, 10, 20 women write to me a week, wives, total strangers asking for advice, counseling about marriages where there's a pornographic addiction. And that also leads to judgment. So these are all unhealthy influences that we need to slowly marginalized from our relationships. And like I said at the very outset of this interview, if our marriages need help, if we need to go to a professional counselor, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, when I ran for Congress back in 2012, one of the principal planks of my policy agenda was to make marital counseling tax deductible in the United States, because many marriages need help. A lot of people can't afford it, or it's taboo. But if you're feeling judged in your relationship, that's something that you and your husband may have to bring before a professional counselor. And we have to get rid of the taboo. There's nothing wrong with seeking help. And if you don't feel comfortable going to counseling, as it were, because you're concerned that it bespeaks a crisis in the relationship, then go to a wise friend. But don't bury that feeling.
I want to talk about something that you touched on, and that was adultery. Do I understand that you were saying that men commit adultery because they don't feel validated?
No, I reject that utterly. A man or a woman can find any excuse on earth as to why they will be unfaithful. And yet there is no valid excuse, because adultery is about being a liar. It's about being deceptive. It's about being duplicitous. So if you don't feel validated in your marriage, go for counseling. And God forbid, if the marriage begins to deteriorate to the extent that it cannot be resuscitated, it cannot be revived, then you could even get divorced. Divorce is sad, but it's not immoral. Adultery is immoral. Adultery is about duplicity. It's about fraudulence. It's about deep, deep, irreversible pain that you bring to the person that trusts you more than any other on earth. There's no excuse for it.
Does anything go in the bedroom in Jewish terms?
Well, Judaism is famous for its laws of the mikveh. So we take there's a period of sexual abstention for 12 days out of every month. I believe that's actually very healthy for a marriage. I write about it extensively in my book, Kosher Sex. So not everything goes, because if sex is something that becomes so available, there's no longer a lust or a yearning for it, it's no longer as exciting. And certainly it bears saying that there's no such thing in Judaism or in any moral context of anything that would happen in the marriage that would not be completely consensual, even in marriage. You know, you both have to feel very comfortable. And by the way, one of the reasons that we have to emphasize that is that so often sex in marriage becomes something that is not a joyous celebration of love, but sometimes it can feel almost like a duty, a chore. Judaism doesn't allow that. The Talmud is so emphatic that a husband has to celebrate sexually with his wife, and a woman has to feel that way with her husband at all times. It should never feel like some kind of matrimonial duty. In fact, the Talmud says something fascinating, that a man isn't even supposed to think about another woman when he's making love to his wife, and a woman's not supposed to think about another man, even though your spouse might never know, but God knows, and it's not an act of intimacy if you're mentally focused on a stranger. So I wouldn't say that anything goes, but I would say that Judaism is all about sexual liberation in marriage. That in marriage, we do want to emphasize always this idea of finding sexual fulfillment and finding sexual joy. And we don't believe that sex is primarily about procreation. We believe that it's about intimacy. As it says in Genesis chapter 2, verse 24, therefore shall a man leave his father and leave his mother, he shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Very beautiful romantic statement in the Bible.
Judaism is brilliant in how it recognizes the relationship between emotional and mental connection and physical connection. Because 2 weeks of the month, you have to dedicate your time to building the relationship. And 2 weeks of the month, because of the Taharas Mishpacha laws and the family purity laws, you can be with your husband physically. It's perfect. And I have spoken to couples who are well into their 80s, and both of them have told me, both partners have told me that even though the wife doesn't go to mikveh anymore, they've maintained that model. When they are together, it's worth that 2 week wait. It's really, it's a beautiful system.
Yeah. And I speak about that in my book, Kosher Lust, that we don't just want to have love in relationships and in marriage. We want to have lust. We want to have deep desire. We want to have teshuka, as the word in Hebrew, this ecstatic desire that a woman wants to feel chosen by her husband. A man wants to feel desired by his spouse. So mikveh really allows the regeneration of effectual desire and lust. The 10th commandment is thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, which by direct implication means that you should be coveting your own wife, that lust and covetousness in marriage is extremely appropriate and healthy. It's just not healthy when it's outside of marriage, of course. Our Christian brothers and sisters have 7 deadly sins, one of which is covetousness. But we Jews don't think that covetousness or lust is a sin. It's all about who you lust after. For a husband to lust after his wife is extremely kosher. To lust after someone who isn't is not kosher. For a wife to really lust after her husband, that's a very healthy thing. And the mikveh allows for stoking lust in marriage. So that's why I wrote a whole book about this called Kosher Lust. And then Pamela Anderson and I wrote a book together called Lust for Love, which was a translation of this kosher lust idea in marriage into like the culture and universalizing the idea well beyond Jewish marriages. And we don't see enough desire in marriage today. You know, you started by asking why are so few men and women marrying today? And I think that's one of the reasons. They know that marriage can bring love, and people believe that marriage can bring connection. It can bring stability. But they don't think it can create real lust. They don't think it can sustain passion and vigor. But I believe that, of course, it can. And it all comes down to how we go about the mechanics of marriage. So the mikveh is a vital mechanism in marriage. And it's something that I think, when I published Kosher Sex 20 years ago, we just published the 20th anniversary edition, I actually advocated that non-Jewish couples keep the 12 days of this hiatus in a marriage that allows for yearning and desire. And it was, and the idea of mikveh when I published the book, and you know, among in the non-Jewish audience, the book was translated into many languages and it was a bestseller in many countries, you know, in the non-Jewish community. There were so many non-Jewish women, who had never heard of mikveh, who wanted to understand this concept and wrote to me about it. And as you just said, Judaism has so much wisdom when it comes to relationships. I kind of lament the fact that we, the Jewish people, don't always see ourselves as the Bible sees us, a light unto the nations, that we should be enriching people's lives. We should be enriching their marriages. We have so much wisdom about how to be inspirational parents, how to be active members of a community and contributing to our community. Look at, thank God, because we were an exile people for 2,000 years. Now, you know, we're blessed with the majestic state of Israel, where the Jewish people have recreated their ancient homeland. But for 2,000 years, we were an exiled people. So our creative energies went into the microcosmic efforts of family, community, and personal development and growth, as opposed to the macrocosmic developments of empire, government. We didn't have a state. And we became so adept at those three incredible institutions of personal growth, community, and family. But if you look at the world today, those are the three areas that people are really seeking guidance on. We just had the Olympics in Tokyo, and what we saw is even world champions who were brave and courageous about speaking about mental health issues. And depression is a big problem throughout the Western world, especially in developed countries, which is something that was not necessarily predictable. We wouldn't have expected that the wealthiest countries would have some of the biggest challenges in mental health. We would have thought that wealth would bring some kind of satisfaction, joy. Instead, we're seeing, you know, massive problems of unhappiness. And so the Jewish people have focused tremendously on a sense of purpose, people feeling individually fulfilled. And then, of course, we focus on family. And of course, we focus on community. So I agree with you that there's so much wisdom in Judaism, not just in mikvah, but in so many other areas, which is why I kind of try to write these books. The conversation we're having right now, I hope the Jewish community understands that whatever is true for our community is also true for the teachings we share with every other community. One of the things I love about South Africa is that it's a very multi-ethnic community. You know, I started visiting South Africa in the 1990s, right after the end of apartheid and the presidency. I was there when President Mandela became president. And South Africa electrified the world in showing a harmonious coexistence, white and black communities. But that's not enough to coexist. We want to see people enriched by difference. And South Africa is an example of that. But the Jewish people have also kind of led in that sphere, because we have been a minority living in every country and in every, among every religion. And we've tried to contribute to those overarching cultures. That we have retained our identity as Jews in places like South Africa, the United States, and Belgium, and the UK, and Australia, where we are minorities. And the fact that we have preserved the minority status of our Islamic brothers and sisters in Israel, where we are a majority, it just shows that we believe in being a blessing to all peoples, all religions, all nations at every time and in every place. And sometimes we do it through our teachings on marriage. Sometimes we do it through our teachings, the Torah reading, the Bible reading every single week. Sometimes we do it through helping people foster a greater sense of community. And sometimes we do it through giving people a greater sense of individual connection with God. But in all things, we, the Jewish community, have to go beyond what our own focus on ourselves and the health of the Jewish community. And we have to contribute to the wider community. So this whole conversation about kosher sex, and it pertains to all nations, all people, all ethnicities. And yeah, we have to be, as the Bible says, a light unto the nation.
I'm Kathy Kalin. This is Community in Conversation on 101.9 High FM. Please note, this program is not suitable for children. Rabbi Shmuley Boteach is my guest today. He's an Orthodox rabbi. He's an author. He's a TV host. He's written 31 books. Maybe we should be talking about time management, Rabbi.
Because it's 2:15 a.m. Let me just say a warm, heartfelt greeting to my Jewish brothers and sisters in South Africa, in Cape Town, in Durban, in Johannesburg, and to my non-Jewish brothers and sisters in South Africa. I've done a bunch of media tours in South Africa, and I was so honored that I was on all the, you know, on Jewish shows, like this beautiful show on Chai FM, but I was also on all the mainstream shows. I love South Africa. It's such a warm and vibrant country. As I just said, it's an example to the world of harmonious coexistence. Every time I've been there, I've been electrified by its beauty, by it's such a painful history. South Africa's a light to the nations in that regard. And I would love to see one thing, if I may. I'd love to see much stronger bridges built between South Africa and the state of Israel. I know that there is at times tension, and we read about this here in the United States. And I saw it when I was in South Africa. When I was in South Africa doing book tours for my books on relationships, I was very often asked by television hosts and radio hosts about how can I, as an American Jew who believes in democracy and human rights, how could I not call out Israel? They would ask me for what these hosts perceived as human rights abuses, et cetera. And I explained to them that, to the contrary, that Israel is just a paragon of human rights and freedom and democracy and all the things that South Africa has sought to build since 1994. And to the extent that it's misportrayed, it's because we, the Jewish people, as so many of our brothers and sisters in minority communities around the world have experienced, we've been demonized. We've been falsely maligned by people who want to blight our influence. But I think that there's just a natural connection between the human rights aspirations in South Africa that have become such an inspiration to the whole world, and in Israel's aspirations to build a thriving democracy in the world's most tyrannical region, and Israel's success at doing so, and Israel's phenomenal respect for minority rights and the rights of our Palestinian brothers and sisters and Islamic brothers and sisters. Israel has 1.5 million Arab citizens. That's a very large percentage of the population. I would love to see much stronger bridges built between South Africa and Israel. And I'd like to see an honest and sincere discussion of many of these misunderstandings. Because whenever I see any tension between Israel and South Africa, it causes me tremendous pain, because these are two countries that have so much in common and that we should just seek to build more bridges. So the next time I come on your show, God willing, I hope that we'll be able to discuss that as well.
Before I even let you go, I cannot let you go without discussing kosher hate, how to fight Jew hatred, racism, and bigotry.
Well, kosher hate is all about hating evil. It's not true that hatred is something that is entirely rancid or destructive. We have a moral obligation to stop evil and to confront it and to fight it. Apartheid is a perfect example. If we do not feel a moral revulsion, a kosher hatred for the evils of apartheid, for the moral abomination of a black man, woman, or child who were treated like they were lesser children of God, who were oppressed, brutalized, abused by a system that robbed them, not just of their political rights and their human rights, but of the recognition of the infinite spark of God that was within them. If we can't hate apartheid, then what does that say about our moral compass? What does that say about our own sense of moral excellence? You can't love the victims without hating the brutal oppression that robbed them of their rights.
What you're saying, I want to just put it in context, because something that's foremost in my mind at the moment is 26-year-old Ellie Kay, who was killed in a terror attack in Jerusalem on Sunday, the 21st of November. That's what hate did. Hate took away his beautiful potential, his life. Where is there room for any kind of hate in Judaism?
Well, think about it. The story of Ellie Kay is absolutely heartbreaking. A South African Jew makes Aliyah to Israel, serves in the IDF to protect the people that experienced the genocide just 75 years ago, and to fight in an army that has carved out a bastion of freedom, the world's most tyrannical region. And he is targeted for murder for one reason only, because he's a Jew. In the same way that our black brothers and sisters can understand being targeted just for the color of your skin, he was murdered only because he was a Jew. Now, we have to love his memory and perpetuate his memory. But to say that we should not hate the perpetrators, Hamas. Hamas is a bloodthirsty death cult who have a charter that calls for a second Holocaust of the Jewish people. The Hamas charter says that every L.E.K. should be killed, not just as an adult, not just a former lone soldier of the IDF, but any civilian, and not just in Israel. Hamas charter calls for every Jew in South Africa to be murdered, every Jew in the United States to be murdered. They want every Jew everywhere on earth to be killed. What am I supposed to feel towards Hamas? Love? God forbid. Neutrality? Elie Wiesel said that neutrality towards evil is even worse than joining it, to be the innocent bystander who just watches. Elie Wiesel always said the opposite of love is not hate. The opposite of love is indifference. So it can't be neutrality I'm supposed to feel towards Hamas. The only logical conclusion is I'm supposed to feel kosher hate. I'm supposed to be reviled by everything they stand for so that we fight them. Israel has had to fight Hamas. We've had four wars since Israel withdrew from Gaza in 2005. The world continues to fund Hamas. The world continues. So when you say about L.E.K., there are people giving this terrorist organization money so they can kill more L.E.K.s. So to say that we shouldn't feel kosher hatred towards them, how are we going to stop them? what is going to inspire us to combat them? What is going to motivate us to neutralize their terrorism? That's the question I pose to everyone listening in my book, Kosher Hate.
Rabbi Bater, emotion propels us and motivates us into action. When we feel love, we take action on that. We give a hug. We do an act of kindness. What do we do with kosher hate? It's one thing hating Hamas, but what do we do with that hate?
That's exactly why I wrote the book. The world turned a blind eye to Hitler. It didn't want to fight Hitler because it didn't hate Hitler. It always excused Hitler. You have to understand Hitler has to cater to his base. He has to use this anti-Semitic rhetoric. But once he gets in power, he's going to be more responsible. Oh, and then the Nuremberg laws of 1934, that's not so serious. Okay, it's just Jewish businesses. Oh, then he's only expelling the Jews by 1936, 38, 39. He's not yet slaughtering them. And then once we knew about the Holocaust in the midst of the Second World War, we don't have to bomb the train tracks to Auschwitz. There were always reasons that we overlooked the genocide of the Jews. Winston Churchill was different. He actually used the word hatred when he came to Hitler. He said he hated Hitler. And he alone, you know, Chamberlain was prepared to wave a worthless piece of paper in 1937 in Munich and make a peace agreement with Hitler. So was Pope Pius XII of the Catholic Church, who before he was Pope signed a concordat between the Catholic Church and Nazi Germany. It was people like Churchill who, because of their hatred of Hitler, fought him and refused to make peace with him. Abraham Lincoln said that he hated the institution of slavery. Here in the United States, we had a civil war that took the lives of 700,000 Americans that had to lead to the abolition of slavery. Terrible, terrible price to pay. But Abraham Lincoln said he hated the institution of slavery. George H.W. Bush, the 41st president of the United States, in the first Gulf War, said that he hated Saddam Hussein. He used that word, that he hated him. A lot of people found the expression of hatred inappropriate for a president. But Saddam Hussein killed 1.1 million people. He killed 800,000 Arabs. He killed 300,000 Kurds. And again, I pose the question to whoever feels uncomfortable with kosher hatred. What are you supposed to feel towards mass murderers? What are you supposed to feel towards terrorist organizations? What are you supposed to feel towards Osama bin Laden? What are you supposed to feel towards modern-day Hamas? What are you supposed to feel towards Ayatollah Ali Khamenei of Iran, who is planning a genocide of the Jewish people? And if not for the fact that we have an Israel Defense Forces and not for the fact that we have a strong American military or American sanctions on Iran, would be building, you know, nuclear weapons as we speak. And they've called Israel a one-bomb state. It's only our hatred of evil regimes like Iran that brutalize their own people that inspires us to resist them. So to end on a policy note, right now, President Biden is contemplating a revival of the Iran nuclear agreement that was, or a form of it that was signed by President Barack Obama in 2015. I think that that nuclear agreement was a disgrace to the United States because it not only did it legitimize the Iran nuclear program, but it gave them $150 billion in unfrozen assets. And what did they use that money for? They used it for terrorism, to kill people. But if you hate that regime because you know that they're brutalizing innocent, their own people, it's not the Iranian people we hate, God forbid, it's the evil regime, then we will not agree to the easing of sanctions. We won't give that government money. We won't let them just have the facilities by which to murder people around the world, and we won't give them a nuclear bomb.
It's so interesting, this conversation, especially everything that we've said today has been interesting, Rabbi. Hate, as I see it, does two things. One, it makes us the victim. And two, whatever we hate retains its control over us for as long as we hate it. And that's how we become victims. An example is the Palestinian people. This hatred that they have for Israel, and I am generalizing, the hatred that they have for Israel has kept them subjugated. In many ways, they just can't move on. The other part is obviously political with their own government. We see exactly the opposite of this statement in what happened in South Africa in 1994. So whatever we hate retains its control over us for as long as we hate it. When we came out of apartheid, what happened in South Africa was miraculous because people of all colors and cultures and creeds let go of their hatred.
Yeah, I respectfully disagree. In the same way there's kosher love and unkosher love, there's kosher hate and there's unkosher hate. Kosher love is a man loving his wife. Unkosher love is a man loving, you know, his mistress. And to say that in the same way that you said that, well, if we hate it all, it'll overtake us. I can say that if I love, it'll overtake me. I can say that if a woman loves her husband unconditionally, she'll start loving her coworker and she'll be unfaithful. We can control who is the object of our love. And the same thing is true. We can control who's the object of our hate. The reason why South Africa came out of the brutality of apartheid was because people began to hate, thank God, the abomination of apartheid. And they should hate the abomination of apartheid. They understood it was ungodly, inhuman, vile, disgusting, stomach-turning, that it was an affront to God, an affront to humanity, and it was something that we had to hate, resist, fight, and abolish. Kosher hate is a very powerful weapon against evil. Apartheid is evil. The only moral response to evil is to hate it, fight it, resist it, and to be liberated from it. So I ask anyone who's listening to me, what do you feel? Neutrality? Love? God forbid. The only moral response is that you hate apartheid. No, listen, it's just that apartheid was the most egregious example of racism in our time. But I just came from Memphis, Tennessee, just a few days ago, for those who follow me on my social media feeds, where I visited the site of the assassination of Martin Luther King, the greatest American of the 20th century, who was felled by an assassin's bullet on the 4th of April, 1968. And while America didn't have, well, you know, we had something far worse. We had slavery, but that ended in 1865. But then it became, you know, slavery almost by other means through Jim Crow laws, segregation, et cetera. And we were liberated from that through the incredible life and legacy of a man who was murdered at the age of 39, Martin Luther King Jr. The person who killed him, James Earl Ray, was a white racist. I have no problem saying openly that I hate the memory of James Earl Ray. I do. He was a monster. A monster. I'm sorry. We should not be mincing words anymore about people like him. A white racist who kills the greatest American of the 20th century simply because he was trying to liberate God's children from living under Jim Crow and segregation. What am I supposed to feel towards the memory of someone like that? Now let's take it to an even greater extreme. What am I supposed to feel towards the memory of Adolf Hitler? Is it not hatred? I mean, let's get serious here. To all my Christian brothers and sisters who are listening, who would say to me, well, you know, Jesus does say that you're supposed to love your enemy. And Jesus does say you're supposed to turn the other cheek. Well, I wrote a book called Kosher Jesus. And I explained there, Jesus was very precise. He said you're supposed to love your enemy. Your enemy is the person who steals, who takes your parking space, you know, at the mall. Your enemy is, I don't know, a coworker who got your promotion or you thought was supposed to be your promotion. But a racist, a murderer, a terrorist, they're not your enemy. They're God's enemy. Jesus never said love God's enemy. He was very specific. Love your enemy. And he said, turn the other cheek, meaning overcome petty slights. If someone offends you, learn to forgive them. But did Jesus mean that we should overlook terrorism, mass murder, the killing in cold blood of L.E.K., the genocide of the Jewish people in the Holocaust, the genocide of the Armenians in the First World War, the genocide of the Cambodians 1975 to 1978, the genocide of 880,000 innocent Africans in Rwanda, the Tutsi at the hands of the Hutus, and some innocent Hutus who were also murdered in Rwanda, 1994, or Srebrenica, Kosovo, all the genocides of the 20th century, now into the 21st century, the Uyghurs in China. Did Jesus mean that you're supposed to turn the other cheek and overlook that and allow another mass murder? Of course not. Of course not. And that's what the book argues. But I do want to thank you very much for having me. I hope people will buy a copy of Kosher Hate, read the book, decide for themselves. If they disagree with me, then at least let's have a discussion about this. But you can download Kosher Hate. I don't know if the book is available yet in South Africa. You can buy it on Amazon. But you can get it on Kindle, get an electronic version. But let me be clear. I don't write books so that I will say definitively that I'm right. And to the extent that people feel I'm not right when it comes to kosher hate, I respect that valid, logical, rational arguments from the other side. But I write my books to create discussion and to create a healthy debate. And the more we communicate, the better it's all going to be. But I wrote this book because I'm just sick of all the evil in the world. It has roamed for too long. Genocide is just one genocide after another. We said never again after the Holocaust. And then 30 years later was Cambodia. And 20 years later was Rwanda. And 10 years later was the three genocides of the former Yugoslavia, Kosovo, Srebrenica. So all these things continue to happen. I'm sick of it. And we should all be sick of it. We have to tap into our kosher hate to fight evil and just stop it once and for all.
Rabbi Shmuley Bater, thank you so much. His new book is called Kosher Hate, How to Fight Jew Hatred, Racism, and Bigotry. I wish you a Shabbat Shalom. Thank you so much for your time. Have to get you back. I want to talk about kosher Jesus. I want to talk about pornography. Definitely we have to talk more about relationships. So thank you very, very much for the time. I hope that you can get a good night's sleep now.
Thank you very much for having me. And as I said, not that it's a big deal, but it's a mark of my love for the South African Jewish community and the country as a whole. Beautiful, glorious South Africa that I did stay up in the middle of the night to do this interview just because I so miss the community. Some of the most special moments of my life, honestly, were in South Africa. Just, I miss it so much. I hope I'll be visiting soon, God willing.
Thank you to Rabbi Shmuley Bater, Orthodox rabbi, author of 31 books, including the bestseller Kosher Sex, A Recipe for Passion and Intimacy, and Kosher Jesus. In conclusion, the South African apartheid referendum in 1992 was the last whites-only election held in South Africa. When I voted yes to get rid of apartheid, it wasn't because of my hatred of apartheid. It was because of my love for my South African countrymen. Apartheid was a despicable system. It was immoral, unjust, and cruel. But that's not why I voted to end it. Only love has the power to conquer evil, to motivate us to change what needs to be changed. I have said it before and I will say it again. Hatred is not sustainable. It makes victims of us all. It holds us back, and it gives power to that which we hate. Only love can change the world. I wish you and yours a loving and peaceful Shabbat, dear friends. I'm Kathy Kayla, and this has been Community in Conversation on 101.9 Chai FM. Take a listen to this. You've never said no to your daughter, not when she wanted another bedtime story or a princess party, and you won't say no when she wants to go to film school in New York one day. If your goal is to give your kids everything they dreamed of, Liberty gives you global exposure to grow your investment further. Speak to a Liberty financial advisor or your broker about investing together in your goals. Liberty, in it with you. Liberty Group Limited is a licensed insurer and an authorized FSP. T's and C's apply.
It's a community in conversation. Join Kathy Kayla every Friday at 9 a.m. for Community in Conversation. Be brave enough to start a conversation that matters. Right here on 101.9 Chai FM.